bad having a nurse for a grandmother. I told her the whole story. She didn't lecture or scold. She simply said, "You know, if you stop talking so much, maybe you could see some of them hits coming." Then she kissed me and went on her way. I couldn't stop thinking about Gigi's words. She was right. I was talking all the time, always joking. I never shut up. I talked not because I had anything particularly important to say, but because I was afraid. It began to dawn on me that my overcompensation and fake bravado were really just another more insidious manifestation of the coward. My thoughts were swirling. My mind drifted to the time when Gigi found my first rap book. Like most kids emulating their hip-hop idols, I had been writing verses full of curse words and slick, slangy vulgarities, and I had accidentally left my book out in the kitchen. Gigi found it and read it. She never said anything to me, but she wrote me a note on the inside front cover. "Dear Willard, truly intelligent people do not have to use language like this to express themselves. God has blessed you with the gift of words. Be sure you are using your gifts to uplift others. Please show the world that you are as intelligent as we think you are. Love, Gigi." Lying in my bed, I was overcome with shame. Had I used my words to uplift others? I thought about this kid sitting in a jail cell somewhere. What is his grandmother doing right now? He had potentially thrown his whole life away, a demise maybe not caused, but certainly provoked by my words. I knew for certain I didn't want to be that kind of person. But my shame slowly began to give way to a staggering realization of the power of words. I knew that I had unconsciously caused my whole day. I didn't know exactly how, but I knew for damn sure I had done it. I sensed for the first time that I wasn't weak. In fact, I was infinitely powerful. I just had no control over it. My imagination was running wild with the possibilities. God had indeed blessed me with the gift of words. And that night, I was getting my first glimpse of the power of those words to alter and shape my reality. And then I asked myself, if I have this much power, shouldn't I use it for good? Words can affect how people view themselves, how they treat each other, how they navigate the world. Words can build people up or they can tear them down. I decided that night I wanted to use my words to empower others, to help rather than hurt. I never cursed again in my rhymes, and I got criticized and smashed for years for that choice. But there was no peer pressure that even came close to overriding Gigi pressure. Those first months of high school were a little rocky, but I was certainly no longer anonymous. And in the same way that the power of my words had almost destroyed me, I was now starting to see their power painting my dreams. By the middle of that school year, hip-hop had really started to bubble in Philly. And now everyone had their own Cousin Paul, somebody they knew in New York who could get them mixtapes. The success of Rapper's Delight by the Sugar Hill Gang was putting major dents into mainstream barriers. Everybody was listening to that song all the time. Walking the halls of Overbrook that year was like walking through a hip-hop battleground. Hip-hop may not have been on TV, it may not have been on the radio, but at Overbrook High, everybody was rapping. Nobody knew it yet, but I had been writing rhymes every day for the past 8 months. I had pages and pages of different concepts and punchlines and stories. I started to keep a stash memorized and ready to go. I would walk up on a group of kids rapping and join in, and I slowly started to develop a reputation as a pretty good rapper. The new thing was freestyling. Somebody would beatbox with their mouth, and then the rapper would improvise in the moment about whatever was around them. Some kid's funny shoes, the tests you failed in math class, the girl you like, whatever. This was my biggest strength. I had been cracking jokes my entire life. Now all I had to do was make them rhyme, and people were flipping. The best beatboxer in the whole school was a guy named Clarence Holmes. Everybody called him Clate. Not only could he generate the most bass, but he could mimic the actual sounds of popular breakbeats. And on top of that, Clate could do sound effects. He could make a bird noise in the hallway that was so realistic, people would be turning around to see who let a bird in here. I soon realized that every time Clate beatboxed for me, he always made me sound better. I started seeking him out every day after school. I'd roll up and hit him with our standard greeting. "Sup, C, you ready to rock?" "You know what it is," he'd say. Clate was always ready to rock. Always. So much so that we all started calling him Ready Rock C. Pretty soon, what started out as just casual freestyle sessions, rhyming and flowing and trying to one-up each other, morphed into what became known as battles. I would step up and do a verse, and then the other kid would try to one-up me. Maybe he'd make fun of my hair or my clothes. Then when his verse was finished, I had to step back in and freestyle a response. The judge of who won was determined mainly by who got the biggest laugh or cheer from the crowd. If you won the crowd, you won the battle. I was invincible. Two words, scorched earth. There were some guys who were cleverer than me, had tighter flows or better voices or more developed poetic sense, but nobody was as funny as me. Nobody could rock the crowd with a punchline the way I did. What nobody seemed to ever understand was that you can't beat funny. You can spit all the tough gangster shit you want. You can rip rhymes about all the money and women in the world. But if your pants are just a little bit too far above your shoes, and somebody says, "Look at you, homie, thinking you all fly. Look like your shoes went to a party and your pants got high." And 40 people laugh, you're done. It's over. Rapping changed everything for me. For the first time in my life, I was popular. I was getting attention and respect. Ready Rock and I were from Winfield, but Overbrook was in Hilltop. Many times in these battles, we'd be repping for Winfield. So a lot of the same neighborhood guys who used to pick on me and make fun of me were now getting hype when I showed up. I was making new friends. Girls were starting to feel me. Ready Rock and I became inseparable. The other reason I never lost a rap battle was because I had been raised in the house of Daddy-O, molded and chiseled by his unrelenting work ethic. I practiced incessantly. Unlike the other kids who were starting to smoke weed and cut class, I spent hours and hours filling notebooks with rhymes every day. I'd stand in the mirror and practice my verses, making sure my face and my body language were perfectly matched to reinforce and punctuate the punchlines. I was tightening my delivery and trying to deepen my tone. Every break between class and before and after school, I was always looking for some sucker who was slipping. I'd battle anybody in the lunchroom, in the parking lot, at the Tustin playground, or in Bieber's schoolyard. In class, I started having fun with my teachers, rhyming answers back when they called on me. I'd rhyme to my parents. I'd answer the phone in rhymes. A lot of adults pretended like they hated it, but I knew they loved it. The combination of hip hop and humor made me untouchable. I had found my voice. I was choosing my words poetically and comedically. And now, for the first time, I was experiencing a surge of power over my own life. My teachers love me. I'd be late for class or miss my homework or get caught being silly in the back of the room. They couldn't yell at me because they were laughing. I started to notice that I was never getting in trouble. One of my favorite teachers was Miss Brown. She taught Algebra 2, Elementary Functions, and Trig. She had flawless chocolate skin and big, steady brown eyes. Her body was just under 5 feet tall, but she was 6'8" on the inside. She knew exactly what I was doing. By this point, I was at least a foot taller than her, and when I would do something that she needed to check me for, she'd walk right up into my chest and say, "Come down here so I can talk to you." Learning is really easy when you can feel that your teachers love you. Miss Brown began to jokingly call me Prince Charming. She'd sarcastically say things like, "Oh, look, Prince Charming has graced us with his homework this Monday morning. How kind of him." The kids would laugh and I would eat it up. As long as everybody's laughing, I'm good. Back in the 80s, the word fresh was the new hip-hop slang. Everybody was saying it every other word, like fly in the 70s or dope in the 90s. In the 80s, if something was hot, you'd say, "Man, that's fresh." One day I came running into Miss Brown's class literally 45 seconds after the bell. And looking at her watch, she said, "His Highness the Prince, 2 minutes late." I quickly corrected her. "Nah, Miss Brown, we both know I am barely 30 seconds late. And if you don't mind, thenceforth and hitherto do I demand to be known as the Fresh Prince." The classroom burst out laughing. The name stuck. In order to feel confident and secure, you need to have something to feel confident and secure about. We all want to feel good about ourselves, but many of us don't recognize how much work that actually takes. Internal power and confidence are born of insight and proficiency. When you understand something or you're good at something, you feel strong, and it makes you feel like you have something to offer. When you have adequately cultivated your unique skills and gifts, then you're excited about approaching and interacting with the world. And what I learned from Paul was that being good at something allows you to be calm in a storm, knowing that you can handle whatever comes. There is a great Bruce Lee quote that resonates with me. One of Lee's students once asked him, "Master, you constantly speak to us of peace, yet every day you train us to fight. How do you reconcile these conflicting ideas?" And Bruce Lee responded, "It is better to be a warrior in a garden than a gardener in a war." Rapping didn't just win me the approval I desperately craved from my peers. It gave me a sense of power. But I knew it was fleeting. It demanded my constant attention and nurturing. I knew I was good, but I also knew that I had to work. It wasn't going to just come to me. I had to go get it. I kept seeing her in the hallways. I'd even had a dream about her, but we were from two different cliques. I was rapping now, so I was rolling with the cool kids, but she wore big-ass glasses. And her and all of her friends were in the art program and lugged around those big-ass portfolio bags. But Melanie Parker was beautiful. She noticed me soon after the unfortunate lock incident. She was a mochaccino-flavored cutie. She had that sort of goofy, gorgeous genius thing, a beguiling mixture of insecurity and quirkiness surrounding a simmering core of artistic brilliance. We had been sniffing around each other for a few weeks, and I could tell that she was far too much of a lady to speak first. She had gorgeous mahogany eyes and a springtime smile that I would come to understand was painted on top of hidden layers of sadness. Melanie was a broken angel. And from the moment I saw her, I wanted nothing more than to take care of her. So I pressed up on her. "What's up, cutie? I'm the prince," I said. She smiled politely and said, "What does your mother call you?" I was thinking, damn, my mother calls me by my government name. "Well, she calls me Willard," I said, "but you can call me Willard," she interrupted. "Nice to meet you, Willard. I'm Melanie." She never called me Will. She never called me Prince. She called me asshole once or twice. But to this day, she calls me Willard. "Look, that's a big-ass art bag," I said. "May I carry it for you to your next class?" Melanie paused. I sensed that she already liked me, but she felt like she had to make it difficult. She handed me the bag without a word and walked off to class. I followed her, already completely in love. When we reached her classroom, I handed her the bag. "I think you should let me carry it home for you too this afternoon," I said. "You should rest your art muscles." I would walk Melanie home from Overbrook every day. She took easily to wonder and awe. Everything was interesting to her. She was one of those people who could stop and look at a tree for 10 minutes. Melanie lived in the opposite direction from Woodcrest, so I'd walk 10 minutes to her house, carrying her big-ass art portfolio all the way, then 20 minutes back to mine, thinking about those eyes all the way home. Melanie was born and raised in Minneapolis. Her household was filled with violence to a tragic extreme. Her mother ended up killing her father and went to prison for it. Her mother incarcerated, Melanie moved to Philly to live with her aunt, a strict Muslim who opened her home to her niece, but who maintained very strong opinions about how a teenage girl should behave. I never quite got the whole story, but on one occasion, Melanie and her aunt had a very serious disagreement about something, which escalated to the point that her aunt threw Melanie out of the house. Legally, without a place to stay, Melanie could have been sent back to Minneapolis and placed in foster care. I was panic-stricken. I told my mom the whole story and begged her to let Melanie stay with us. "Mom, it'll only be for a little while," I said. "I'll get a job, do whatever I have to get a bunch of money, and me and Melanie will get our own place. I love her, Mommy. Please, can she stay with us till I can figure it out?" My mom's eyes welled, her tears a complex emotional mixture. On the one hand, this was exactly the kind of son she had hoped to raise, loving, responsible, committed. But on the other hand, she knew from personal experience the fragile realities of young love. "Oh, hell no," Daddy-O said. "Carolyn, you know exactly what they're going to be doing." But I had already promised my mother, no sex. Melanie would stay in the basement. I would sleep in my room 2 floors up. It was only temporary. Daddy-O protested, but my mom won this one. I'm still not exactly sure why I did what I did that night. To this day, I have no idea what I was thinking. Of all the experiences I'm sharing in this book, this is the individual moment of personal behavior that makes the least sense to me. Before I reveal what happened, I would like to preface my remarks by making it unequivocally clear that I was deeply and totally in love with Melanie Parker. We were going to be married. We were going to have 4 beautiful mochaccino-flavored children. And our union would live alongside the epic tales of romance. Romeo and Juliet, Tristan and Isolde, Tupac and Janet, even Eddie and Hallie in Boomerang. But at 4 a.m., less than 3 months into our star-crossed love affair, my mom should have been asleep, but tragically decided she wanted a cup of coffee. And wearing slippers, far too quiet to defend her delicate sensibilities, she approached the threshold of the family kitchen. Still innocent, she flipped the light switch, as she had done tens of thousands of times before, But this time, her eyes landed upon her eldest son and his girlfriend deep in the throes of reckless lovemaking. As a teenager, outside of physical injury, you cannot feel worse than having your mother catch you and your girlfriend doggy style on her kitchen floor.
Oh, Willard,
Mom growled, slapping the lights off. Stomping furiously up the stairs, the slamming of her bedroom door functioned as a disastrous exclamation point. Now she wants to make noise. By the grace of God, those few days at Woodcrest allowed Melanie's aunt to calm down and let her move back in. I was only 16, but I was all in. I was determined more than ever to get us our own place so Melanie and I could build a life together. I had gotten my driver's permit just before my 16th birthday. Ready Rock and I loved to drive around West Philly after school every day looking for people to battle. They were pretty easy to find back then. It would be a bunch of dudes standing on a corner in a circle, one of them with their hands cupped around their mouth, bopping their head back and forth, the universal human beatboxing posture. We'd pull the car over, step out, strike the b-boy stance, and it was on. It didn't take but a minute for me to start schooling fools. I'm dropping punchlines, people waving and screaming, like, oh, shit, yo, you heard what he said. The smart guys just quit when they realized I had won the crowd. Because once the crowd is against you, anything you say just makes you look stupider. But some suckers didn't. They would keep trying and keep going, and then two words, scorched earth. By my junior year, I had developed a reputation around West Philly. I joined a crew of slightly older guys. We called ourselves the Hypnotic MCs. The design of the group was based on Grandmaster Caz and the Cold Crush Brothers. We had a DJ and four MCs. DJ Groove on the tables, Jamie Fresh, Sheiky D, my friend Mark Forrest, a.k.a. the Lord Supreme, and me, the Fresh Prince. Ready Rock would pop in and out, but he wasn't really feeling these dudes. I took my role in the Hypnotic MCs very seriously. I attacked it with the discipline Daddy-O had instilled in me. Back then, I hadn't learned yet that most people didn't have the same work ethic as me. I wanted to rehearse every day on a specific schedule. They were looking at it more casually. Sometimes they would show up late to rehearsal and other times not at all. I wanted us to perform at all of the block parties and pool our money to buy equipment, pass out flyers to advertise ourselves, create our own cassettes. Because I was the youngest, they always kind of laughed at me and dismissed my ideas. I did finally convince everybody to put up $200 apiece so we could purchase the brand new SP-12 sampling beatbox. I dug in for a few weeks at the Ice House and came up with my share. We now had a beatbox, four microphones, two turntables, and all the records we'd ever need. Because Groove was the DJ, we agreed to keep all the equipment at his house. We did a handful of pretty good shows together over about six-month period, but mostly the equipment just sat there in Groove's basement unused. I was getting frustrated. Nobody wanted to grind and go get it. My work ethic and constant pushing slowly drove a wedge between me and the group. They resented me for always bugging them and ruining what to them was just supposed to be a fun hobby. I resented them for not putting the effort in to make this thing as good as it could possibly be. I remember being at rehearsal with them and finding myself barking out a Daddy-O axiom. 99% is the same as zero. We started having arguments and fights over everything, over lines, over which breakbeats went best with what harmony, over who would take which verse. Every decision became a chore. Knowing what I know now, I can see that there was no way it could have worked, but back then my mindset was that everything could be fixed. But finally, after months of no progress on recording anything, I went to Groove's house and told the guys that I was out. To them, I was the obnoxious kid who was killing everybody's vibe anyway. They sort of shrugged and shared a laugh between themselves and threw me deuces. So I grabbed my mic and my headphones, and in honor of fairness, I offered to buy the SP-12 back from them. "It's not for sale," Groove said. There was a new coldness in his voice. "Come on, man, y'all not even using that thing," I said. "My dad'll help me with the cash." They just ignored me and kept talking among themselves. It wasn't about the SP-12. It wasn't even about resentment. It was about power. They were disrespecting me because they could. They knew I couldn't do anything. "All right, fine," I said. "Just give me my $200 and y'all can keep it." They all kind of smirked at one another, and then Groove said, "Nope." No argument. Nobody raised their voice. Just no after no. Outwardly, I stayed cool, but a fury was beginning to churn inside me. I had suffered bullying and abuse in my home and all through my childhood, and I was sick of that shit. "Okay," I said calmly, "I'll see y'all later." But as I started to leave, I realized that the SP-12 was sitting right there. So I walked over to it. I paused. Then I snatched it up, violently ripping the cables from the wall, held it high over my head with the knobs facing down, and crash! I slammed it down onto the concrete basement floor. That thing disintegrated. Knobs, plastic, transistors spraying everywhere. "What the fuck are you doing?" Groove screamed. And then I hauled ass up the basement stairs and out into the street. They were right on me in the beginning, but I was the young one. Back in the day, how I was running was known as booking. I put my head down and didn't look back for 8 blocks. When I finally slowed down, there was no one behind me. I was on my own now. All of the windows were broken out of Daddy-O's brand new Chevy van. The radio and all of his tools were gone. Paul had the van when it happened, and he was almost in tears apologizing to Daddy-O. Daddy-O was trying to calm him down. "This shit happens, man. This is why we have insurance," Daddy-O said. But something about Paul's inner code made this unforgivable. He felt like the van was in his possession and he'd been entrusted with it. I had never seen him like this. Paul felt like he had somehow failed and dishonored Daddy-O. Daddy-O could see that thing rising up in Paul, the thing that led to him being in West Philly in the first place. "Hey, Paul, look at me," Daddy-O said. "You know how many times niggas done broke in and stole my shit?" "I know exactly who did it, Uncle Will," Paul said. "Fuck them niggas, Paul," Daddy-O said. "We got too much shit to do. Leave it alone." But Paul couldn't let it go. He was messing with a girl named Shelly who used to mess with this old head named Black. Black ran Winfield. He was always on the corner in front of Mr. Bryant's store with 7 or 8 of his friends. Black was about 6'4" and always had his shirt off. He didn't give a fuck. He would smoke weed outside in the daytime. Paul walked straight up into the middle of the crowd, right up to Black. "Did you touch my uncle's van?" Paul said. Everybody on the corner laughed. "Yeah, I did it. What you gonna do about bloop?" Within a couple of seconds, Black's nose was broken, but he didn't know yet. He wouldn't find out until later when he regained consciousness. I'd never seen a fight like this except in the movies. Paul beat up everybody. Every dude on the corner, either bleeding, running away, or asleep. Paul didn't come home that night or the next. He had disobeyed Daddy-O. I guess that was too much for him to bear. It would be 35 years before I saw him again. Chapter 5. Hope. My mom and Harry moved back into Woodcrest. My family wasn't one that talked about things. I was never privy to what my mom and Daddy-O had decided. I didn't ask. They didn't tell. But whatever it was, he never put his hands on her again. It was midway through my senior year. I had just gotten my SAT scores, low 1200s. This was far from a perfect score, but for a black kid from an inner city school in Philadelphia, those numbers were more than good enough to get me really good options for college. My mom was ecstatic. She was dancing around the house, calling all her friends at Carnegie Mellon and MIT. You'd have thought she was going back to college. My strong subjects were math and science. By 1986, more and more schools were beginning to offer computer science and engineering courses. My mom set up a war room. She had a map of the United States. She was cross-referencing engineering schools with cities and states where we had family members, cost of living, with distance from Philadelphia. With that information at hand, she narrowed down my options to her top five or six schools, organized in order of most likely to least likely acceptance. She then filled out all the applications, handled all of the housing logistics, and weighed all of the travel and financial aid issues. At the time, she worked for the School Board of Philadelphia. So when it came to education, her organization and execution made even Daddy-O applaud. We had family friends in Wisconsin, and suddenly my mom decided we were going to take a quick family trip to see them. The patriarch, Walter McCollum, we called him Uncle Whatchamacallit, was tight with the admissions officer at the university's College of Engineering. She had already gotten my sister Pam into Hampton University, and I was up next. Her wildest dreams as a parent were coming true. All of her kids were going to college. My mom was the commander in charge of the Will Getting Into College mission. All of a sudden, she was very comfortable with the idea that if two people are in charge, everybody dies. It was a Friday night, and my girl Judy Stewart was having her birthday party up the block. I met up with Ready Rock after school. "Yo, you going to Judy's party tonight?" he said. "Nah, man, she played me. I DJed her party for the last 2 years, and she got somebody else and didn't even tell me." "Well, she didn't get just somebody else, man. She got Jazzy Jeff." "Word? I've been hearing about him, but I never saw him cut." "Yeah, man, he's ill," Reddy said. "He's from Southwest, though, and he's going to be in our hood. We going to stand for that?" Reddy Rock always knew how to gas me up for a battle. Not that I needed much fuel. "Yo, what's his rapper's name?" I said. "MC Ice. He can't touch you, though." "Nobody can touch me." Reddy Rock loved when I talked dirty like that. He gave me a pound. My mind was churning with battle rhymes organizing themselves for tonight's slaughter. "You know what? We gonna hit that party tonight and smash these fools," I said. "We gotta rep Winfield." "Bet," he said. "Reddy Rock C and the Fresh Prince versus Jazzy Jeff and MC Ice. I'll meet you there at 8. "I bet. Later." Jeffrey Allen Towns grew up on Rodman Street in Southwest Philly, about 4 or 5 miles from Winfield. Jeff came from a musical family. His father used to MC for the jazz legend Count Basie. His older brothers played in funk and fusion bands, and his sisters were always singing Motown tunes. He was the baby of the family and was a musical sponge, absorbing and processing all the incredible talent that was happening around him. At the age of 15, Jeff was diagnosed with cancer, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. After various painful and difficult treatments, he managed to beat the illness. But his mother became understandably overprotective, and Jeff found himself spending days in the family basement surrounded by 10,000 of his father's and brother's jazz, funk, and blues records. Jeff would spend all day digging through them, listening to everything from John Coltrane and Charlie Mingus to Stevie Wonder and James Brown, noting the different styles, the musicianship, the instrumentation. When he was 10, Jeff had begun DJing. His encyclopedic knowledge made him a musical marvel, Everyone called him Jazz because of his ability to seamlessly blend complex jazz tunes with modern funk, disco, and hip-hop rhythms. Eventually, that got extended to Jazzy Jeff. A lot of you young guns might not know this, but back in the day, DJs were actually more famous than MCs. Rapping was still pretty rudimentary. We hadn't developed the rhythmic or linguistic ingenuity that we have today. Instead, DJing was the innovative and exciting center of attention. It's hard to explain to people who aren't familiar with old school cutting, but Jeff's ability to scratch out rhythms and blend sounds was and still is, for the most part, unparalleled. He pioneered techniques and styles in those Philly basement parties as a teenager that are still used by thousands of DJs all over the world today. He could manipulate records in ways that no one had seen or heard before. He could bend keys and time signatures and alter sounds, one of which I later named the Transformer Scratch because it reminded me of the sound effect from the Transformers cartoon. He could make the vocal lines of two records talk back and forth to each other, creating conversations from two completely different songs. I could go on and on, but I'll stop and just say there's a reason why many, including myself, consider Jeff to be the GOAT of hip-hop DJing. Even today, over 30 years later, he's revered by DJing experts as one of the best in the world. The point is, I know I'm this big famous movie guy, but back in the 80s, Jazzy Jeff was the star. It was me backing him up. That night at Judy's, I showed up early. I made an entrance into her basement, two-tone Lee jeans, black on the back, white on the front, with the fresh prints down the left leg in red letters, and a matching two-tone Lee jacket. I had taken the Lee patch off of the waistband of the pants and had attached it to a silver rope chain around my neck. I was almost too fly for this party. As I stepped into the room, my mind flashed to the last time I had been in Judy's basement. The harrowing events documented in my first single, Girls Ain't Nothing But Trouble, actually happened right here. I was with one of Judy's girlfriends in that basement one night when Judy's father woke up around 2 a.m. to the unmistakable sounds of exquisite lovemaking. My sounds, not hers. From the top floor, I heard him bellowing and tearing down the stairs. Who the fuck is in my house? I bolted up and scrambled naked through the narrow back hall, snatching open the door to the rear driveway, which to my horror had since disappeared under 12 inches of snow. It was 31 degrees, and I had a choice to make. Where is he? Where is he? Judy's father roared. Decision made. I ran a full city block, butt naked, back to my house in the snow. I was outside for over 10 minutes making snowballs trying to hit Harry's bedroom window. Finally, the window goes up and Harry looks down. I had not heard my brother laugh harder before or since. It also happens that Judy's basement was where I met Jeff for the first time. Whatever magic juju Judy had going on in her basement in the mid-80s, apparently Jeff and I owe our careers to it. Thank you, Judy. When I arrived, Jeff was still setting up. Judy introduced us. What up, man? I'm Jazz, he said. Prince, I said, pointing to my leg. I was thinking, this is Jazzy Jeff? He was wearing these big-ass glasses, and he didn't have his name on his clothes anywhere. How was anybody supposed to know he was Jazzy Jeff? There was a Band-Aid around the middle scratching finger on his left hand. Apparently, he had been scratching so much that the top knuckle of his finger now had a bend in it. Everybody was raving about this dude, but I was thoroughly unimpressed. If this joker is the best DJ in the city, I'm sad for Philly. A lot of famous DJs back in those days were flashy, doing backflips and jumping over their turntables and all of that. Jeff was quiet, skinny, soft-spoken, and looked more like a science nerd than a samurai on the wheels of steel. I sat down and chilled while Jeff continued to set up. It's always good to show up early before a battle so you can clock your material. I was plotting all the punchlines I was going to kick about his glasses and his Band-Aid, but I was really going to be battling Ice. A few minutes go by and I say, "Yo, Jazz, where's Ice?" Jeff didn't even look up. I could tell this was a sore subject. "Good question. I called him like 5 times. He never hit me back." Back then, there were no cell phones. You couldn't get in touch with people like today. Judy's guests were arriving now, but there was no sign of Ready Rock. The party was starting. I could see that Judy was getting nervous, and I could sense that Jeff wasn't feeling too great either. My pleaser kicked in, full steam. "Hey, I'll rock with you till Ice gets here if you want," I said. Jeff, relieved, said, "Aw, that would be dope. Thanks, I hate having to talk on the mic." "I got you," I said. "There's nothing I enjoy more than talking on the mic." We both laughed. Judy squealed and clapped her hands. There are rare moments as an artist that you cannot quantify or measure. As much as you try, you can rarely reproduce them, and it's near impossible to describe them. But every artist knows what I'm talking about. Those moments of divine inspiration where creativity flows out of you so brilliantly and effortlessly that somehow you're better than you've ever been before. That night with Jeff was the first time I ever tasted it. The place that athletes call the zone. It felt like we already existed as a group and we just had to catch up to ourselves. Natural, comfortable, home. Jeff could sense my rhyme style. He always knew when my jokes were coming, when to drop the track out so people could clearly hear the punchline, and I could tell by which hand he was using what type of scratch was coming. He preferred different scratches with his left hand than with his right. Sensing this, I could draw the audience's attention to which scratch was coming by which hand he was transitioning to. He was choosing the tracks and adjusting the tempos based on what he felt best accentuated the narrative structure and flow of my rhymes. And just as the music crescendoed, I'd throw down a dagger of a line and Jeff would drop the beat into the funkiest, hottest party rocking shit these Philly kids had ever seen in their lives. That night was crazy. When the party was over, me and Jeff stood out in the driveway, catching our breath and cooling off. We were still hyped. "Yo, that truck turner echo thing you did was blaze," I said. "Your flow sits perfect, locked into that chic bass line," Jeff responded. "Next time we'll use bounce, rock, skate, roll, and then transition into chic." Word. Ideas poured out of us like a fire hose, creativity ricocheting back and forth between us. Everything he said set off 3 ideas in my mind, and my responses had him holding his head and walking around in circles. We never really talked about it, never really made it official, but that wild November night in Judy Stewart's basement, he became my DJ and I became his rapper. From then on, we were DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, just 2 kids from West Philly, partners, friends, brothers. And we still are today. Over the next couple of months, me and Jeff dug in hard. We practiced every day, performed every weekend. He lived in his mother's basement. It was his sanctuary, his magic workshop. When you entered, it felt like you were getting a sneak peek behind the curtain of the wizard. Jeff was the first friend I'd ever had who plain and simple outworked me. I think it would be a misrepresentation to say that he practiced a lot. It wasn't that he was practicing. It was that he didn't do anything else. You'd never catch Jeff in the kitchen or watching TV. You wouldn't show up at his house and see him walking up the front steps coming back from the store. He didn't go to the store. I guess wizards don't do their own shopping. Jeff was standing in front of his turntables 14 to 18 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. It's literally the only image I can conjure of Jeff in his childhood home. Jeff was a mad scientist. He loved technology. He was always waiting for a new gadget to arrive in the mail that you could only get from some 78-year-old guitar builder of questionable history in Vienna. Jeff was moving from solely DJing into beat making and recording. He got a Tascam 4-track recorder, and he was experimenting with creating his own records. He now had a mini studio. Jeff is 3 years older than me, so he had already graduated. But I had to still go to school and work at the Ice House. So by the time I'd get to rehearsal around 4 p.m., Jeff had already put in 10 hours of work. He'd give me 2 tracks to write to. I'd show up the next day with 1 written, and he'd hand me 6 more tracks. This went on for the first few months of our partnership. DJ Jazzy Jeff was a hip-hop terminator. He didn't eat, he didn't sleep, and he absolutely, positively would not stop until you were dead. I tried to keep up. I would stay as late as I could until my mom or daddy-o would call asking me if I knew what time it was. Those early months in Jeff's basement were among the most creative times I've ever experienced. Everything was cutting edge, everything was hot, it was experimental and inspiring. I never wanted to leave. We were seeking our sound, but we found ourselves. One night we were rehearsing in Jeff's basement and some random dude wearing a Lacoste polo shirt, tan khakis with a razor crease and Adidas shell toes crawled through the basement window. He calmly went and took a seat in what clearly he thought of as his corner. The music was playing, and Jeff and I were deeply engaged in our artistic banter, so I guess he didn't want to interrupt us. Jeff didn't react to his presence at all. This went on for a few minutes until I had to break the awkwardness that obviously only I was feeling. "Hey, man, you got to watch wearing those shoes with them pants. If khakis touch shell tops, they could blow your ankles up." I was trying to break the ice, but the dude looked at me, perceiving a challenge, and said, "Oh, is that what we doing? We bussing? Because we can get started with those car door ears of yours." Nah, homie. I'm just messing with you. I'm Will. They call me Fresh Prince." Jeff finally popped out of his nutty professor trance and snapped his headphones off. "Aw, damn, what up, JL?" Jeff said. "When did you get here?" James Lassiter was Jeff's best friend from childhood. JL grew up 1 block over on Hazel Avenue. When Jeff was sick as a child, his mother wouldn't allow him to go off his front porch. So JL would come over and sit for hours and hours with Jeff, keeping him company. This routine continued long after Jeff's recovery and well into their adult lives. JL was a serious cat. When I met him, he was putting himself through Temple Law School. He was studying during the day and working at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital at night. He would stop at Jeff's house for the last 2 hours of his day, part habit, part unwind, part front seat to the evolution of the greatest DJ who has ever lived. Our rise in the Philly hip-hop scene was nuclear. We had done every show we could, block parties, school dances, proms, basement parties, birthdays, fundraisers, and church parking lots, you name it, we did it. We had established a rep as fun, creative, captivating party rockers. Eventually, in early 1986, we scored our first real gig at a major venue, the famous Wynn Ballroom. Wynn was short for Winfield, my hood, my people, with my new DJ, and we smashed it. We were the hottest hip-hop duo in these Philly streets. But our big break came in 1986 when Jeff was invited to compete in the New Music Seminar Battle for World Supremacy. The Battle for World Supremacy was an old-school DJ and MC battle competition held annually in New York City. all of the legends of hip hop had performed and competed in it. Grandmaster Flash, Busy B, Mantronix, Melly Mel, and so on. It was like the Olympics of early 80s hip hop. Local radio DJ Lady B is an iconic pioneer of Philly hip hop. She was playing rap music before anybody in the city, back when it was only on WHAT AM radio. She called Dave Funkenklein, who was one of the event coordinators, and told him that she had a DJ in Philly who was changing the game. Lady B pressed Funkenklein to put Jeff in the competition. Even though it was just 2 hours away by car, the drive felt like a pilgrimage. New York City was the mecca of hip hop. I had never been to New York. To me, the idea that music could be my passport to new worlds excited and inspired me. Here I was, right now, walking through New York City, headed to the coolest event on the planet, and all because of rap music. The battle was being held in the Grand Ballroom at the Marriott Marquis in Times Square. We rolled up 10 deep, full swag, red Phillies caps filled the room. We were intimidated and in awe, but you couldn't tell it from the noise we were making. Philly was now officially in the building. Jeff approached the sign-in table. I was standing behind him, arms crossed, chin high, B-boy stance on swole. Melly Mel walks by to my left, entering the ballroom. My B-boy stance got just a little less swole. And then Grandmaster Flash entered right behind him. For comfort, I put my arms by my side. And then I heard a sound over my shoulder. That outburst you hear when old friends haven't seen each other for a while. I vaguely recognized one of the voices. Where do I know that voice from? And then it hit me. I had never seen him in person before, but I knew it was him. He wasn't rocking a B-boy stance. No flashy clothes, no entourage, but the crowd still parted when he walked through. The undisputed favorite for the MC competition, Grandmaster Caz. As he passed, it took everything I had not to squeal, "I love you, Caz!" Fortunately, he passed quickly and I didn't play myself, but I'm not sure how much longer I could have held out. Jeff finished signing in. I put my hands in my pockets and went quietly to find a seat. There were two sections of the battle for world supremacy, the MC competition and the DJ competition. 8 competitors in each, 3 elimination rounds, last man standing wins. The battle was set up so that each competitor had 3 30-second slots in each round to do their thing. They would go back and forth with their routines, and at the end, the judges would score them, partially based on their techniques and overall performance, but also on the reaction of the crowd. The MCs were up first, and it wasn't even a fair fight. Round after round, rapper after rapper fell to the wit and charisma of my idol. Grandmaster Caz was crowned the world supreme MC, and I could hold out no longer. You Caz! The DJs were up next. Back in the day, this was the battle people really came to see. As the newcomer in the first round, Jeff was paired against DJ Cheese, the previous year's champion. Most DJs had worked out 2 or 4 routines and repeated them throughout the competition. But Jeff had spent the previous week preparing 9 separate 30-second routines. He realized that if there were 3 rounds, each round having 3 slots, that he would be able to go through the whole tournament without ever repeating a single routine. But he took it even further. Each routine was timed perfectly to end in 30 seconds. So whereas other DJs were looking sloppy, getting cut off by the buzzer, or they had a 20-second intro and never really got their routine started, Jeff's perfectly timed routines had punchlines right at 29 seconds. The effect was that Jeff's buzzer became a signal to the crowd to erupt. The first round is set to begin. Jeff walks across the stage, maybe a little overeager, just a bit too happy to be there, and extends a hand of greeting to DJ Cheese. Cheese looks Jeff up and down and flags him, refuses to shake his hand. As Jeff returns to his DJ setup, his cheerful demeanor is gone, and his eyes have turned icy. If Cheese would have known what was coming, he would have just shaken Jeff's hand, or better yet, tried to break it off. Cheese was up first. He came out strong. But Jeff fired back with one of Philly's favorites, a tricky rhythm scratch. People were looking at one another and murmuring, not quite sure what they had just seen. DJ Cheese is eyeballing Jeff, sensing that this is just the beginning. Nobody had ever seen cutting like this. The crowd was inching up onto the edges of their seats. DJ Cheese unleashed his second routine and once again nailed it. The crowd cheers, big scores from all the judges. Then the audience settles down to see what other artillery the Philly Kid has brought with them. And with no announcement and no fanfare, Jeff introduces the world to his Transformer scratch. In 1986, that was the illest thing anybody had ever heard. And that was just the first 10 seconds. He finishes the routine slicing Pump Me Up by Grandmaster Flash in the Furious Five. There's a verse at the end of that song that goes, I'm the bow-legged brother, there'll never be another. I bought a mansion for my mother. Jeff did a breakdown, cutting the last line into syllables. And I bought a mansion for my... And then he held it, letting the clock run out. And at 29 seconds, right before the buzzer, he released the last word. Mother. The buzzer sounded and the crowd lost it. The judges were jumping up out of their seats and walking around with their hands on their heads. Jeff's scratches were so clean, sharp, and calculated that people realized they were witnessing the evolution of the art form. DJ Jazzy Jeff was now serving notice that the road to world supremacy rolled through Philly. Jeff was flawless that night. And when it was all said and done, the 1986 World Supreme DJ was a kid who spent most of his life in a basement in Southwest Philly. My DJ, DJ Jazzy Jeff. Afterward, we all piled into our single room at the Marriott Marquis. We knew something big had just happened. Eric B. and Rakim even came to the room to personally congratulate Jeff. We weren't quite sure where this was all going, but we had the sense that some important fuse had just been lit. We stayed up all night laughing and dreaming, plotting and planning. That night was the first night I realized that the possibilities hip-hop presented me far outstretched anything I had dared to hope for. My whole life, my parents' hopes for me had been predicated on education and hard work. I was supposed to go to college. I was supposed to get a good job. I was supposed to move up in the world. And as the self-designated golden child, I had always committed to living up to my parents' hopes and dreams. I couldn't imagine it otherwise. But by the time we drove home that next morning, New York disappearing behind us, I was struck with an overwhelming conviction. I am not going to college. Dana Goodman had cash. He was about 5'6 and heavy set. Not fat, but thick in a way that he could hurt you if he had to. Approaching 40, he was a Winfield old head. When you would see him standing on the corner, it was only briefly, because he was above those fools. He was doing real shit. Dana was the little brother of Lawrence Goodman, founder of Pop Art Records, one of the first New York-based hip-hop labels. Lawrence was from Philly, but he was killing them in the NYC. Those first few months back in Philly, me and Jeff were on fire. Jeff was now spending 80% of his time making records and 20% DJing. We had finished 6 or 7 songs on Jeff's Tascam 4-track. He had mixed them as best he could, but Jeff was becoming increasingly frustrated that his equipment couldn't quite reproduce the sounds that were trapped in his head. I had recently purchased a Sharp 777, the original hip-hop boombox. It was one of the first times I noticed a major corporation responding to the demands of our burgeoning art form. The 777 was a loud-ass, heavy-ass radio. You had to be strong to carry that thing around. And you had to carry it because for some reason, if you sat it on the ground, it drained your expensive 10D batteries way faster. Best of all, the 777 had dual high-speed cassette replication capabilities. So I would take the cassettes that me and Jeff made home with me, and I would stay up all night high-speed dubbing our demos. This was the old days where you had to do one tape at a time. It was dull and monotonous, you know, like building a brick wall when you're fucking 9. But it needed to be done, so I did it. I then handed those tapes out to everybody. I didn't care if you even knew what hip hop was. If you got 2 ears and a tape deck, then my name's the Fresh Prince. It says it right here on my pants, and I got a tape you gotta hear. Overbrook High was situated in Hilltop, and Hilltop was run by about 30 dudes who called themselves the Hilltop Hustlers. One of the top rappers in that crew was Steady B, and Stead was Lawrence Goodman's nephew. The word on the street was that his uncle had just given him a deal, and he had music coming out later that year. I wanted Stead to get my tape to Lawrence. The problem was I was from across the bridge in Winfield. And if there was one thing that a Hilltop Hustler would never do, it's help a nigga from Winfield. But then it hit me. Dana Goodman lives in Winfield. Maybe he'll pass our tape to Lawrence. Dana and Lawrence, like many brothers, had a bit of a sibling rivalry going on. Dana saw the money his brother was making with his record label, and he hoped to start a label of his own. So after he heard our tape, he called up me and Jeff and said he wanted to meet. So we invited him over to Jeff's to hear us perform. Dana was wearing a dark blue velour Sergio Tacchini sweatsuit, the one with the red and white elastic wrist and ankle bands. The sweatsuit was zipped open just low enough to reveal his 7 or 8 slim gold chains bouncing off the afro on his chest. He was that older dude who almost got away with dressing like the kids, except he had on dress socks. Dana always wore sunglasses, indoors, outdoors, noon, midnight, basketball court, church. You never caught Dana not rocking his shades. That day, Dana pulled up in front of Jeff's house in a brand new 4-door steel blue Audi 4000 CS Quattro 5-speed. And for the first time in my life, I saw a phone in a car. It was the first ever car phone. It was a rotary dial house phone that somehow worked in his car. Dana stepped out on Rodman Street. He was a boss. He was loud. He was a showman. And the sun was banging off his pinky ring. Me and Jeff were standing on his mom's porch. Dana saw us, threw his arms open wide, and in his low, weathered baritone voice, yelled out to the kids playing and the neighbors passing by, "Yo, there they go," pointing to me and Jeff. "That's them, y'all. You better get they autographs now. That's DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. Them boys about to do something." He called me and Jeff down. "Come here, y'all, give me some love." Me and Jeff stepped down to the sidewalk and Dana hugged us like a proud father. "Yo, I love what y'all did up in New York, holding it down for Philly." Me and Jeff smiled. "Well, you know, that's what we do," I said. Just then, one of Jeff's neighbors, a dude a few years older named Keith, called out, "Hey, Dana, that you, man? Oh, shit, it's Dana Goodman. What you slumming, man?" Keith and Dana shook hands, one of those long, elaborate handshakes with multiple steps from a previous generation, which also didn't go with Dana's sweatsuit. What brings you around these parts? Keith asked.
Oh, you know, I'm here to talk to these boys about a little business,
Dana said. Business? Keith looked at me and Jeff. His energy shifted slightly, but our youth and our excitement blinded us to the subtleties. Keith pulled Dana aside, put his arm around him. You know this is Jimmy Towns' little brother, right? Dana looked over at Jeff.
Jimmy Towns' brother?
Keith got up real close to Dana and whispered something in his ear that we couldn't hear. Dana looked down, then started nodding.
Yeah, I got you. I got you, man. This just business. I'm trying to help them.
Family, Keith said, loud enough for us to hear this time. He then said his goodbyes and went back down the street. Dana came down the basement. Me and Jeff let him hear everything we had. Dana picked the two songs he liked most. The first was called Just One of Those Days. Just One of Those Days features a slow 92 BPM groove where I rapped about having one of those days where everything goes wrong. For the chorus, Jeff sampled Irving Berlin's Puttin' on the Ritz, a 1928 ragtime joint that was the first song ever performed in a film by an interracial ensemble. It was pure jazzy Jeff mixing old-time highbrow music with the scratches and rhythms of hip-hop. It crystallized our musical dynamic. Jeff's musical sophistication and in-depth knowledge married to my natural storytelling and humor. The second song was Girls Ain't Nothing But Trouble, the one inspired by Grandmaster Caz's Yvette. This time, Jeff sampled the theme song from the famous 1960s sitcom I Dream a Genie. He used the brand new Roland 909 drum machine, and he detuned the toms to make them sound like a bass line. I told the story of the night in Judy Stewart's basement when my exquisite lovemaking almost got me frostbitten. Dana loved it. He was cracking up.
Yo, did that really happen? Tell the truth. That happened for real?
Yeah, man. I said, that was a rough night. He burst out laughing.
Boy, y'all some talented, funny niggas, he said.
Hip hop has evolved so much over the decades that listening to those songs now, I cringe. They sound so simplistic and repetitive. But back then, what we were doing was revolutionary. Jeff and I played with the structure of songs in a way that no one else in hip hop had up until that point. We had lyricless choruses. We had verses that were half samples, half raps. I was building verses that constructed a full story, each verse leading into the next, begging the listener to finish the song to find out what happened by the end. It was a new day. Dare I say, it was fresh. Dana was bobbing his head to the beat, clapping his hands, stomping, and then finally playing as if he couldn't take it anymore. He said,
"That's enough! That's enough! Turn it off!"
Jeff hit the stop button on the four track. If we had been in a cartoon, Dana would have had spinning dollar signs in his eyes. But in real life, he thumbed the gold chains on his chest and said,
"Oh man, what y'all say we make a record?"
Me and Jeff snapped. We was hyped, jumping, high-fiving, yelling. We was so naive. We thought that was it. You just invite a guy into your house and he says, "Let's make a record." And boom, you a star. We didn't realize that Dana didn't even have a company yet. He had no distribution, very few connections in radio or television. And DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince were his first foray into the music business. A week later, we walked into Studio 4, a professional recording studio that Dana found in downtown Philly. It's hard to describe what Jeff's face looked like when he entered the main control room. It was as if he were a 17-year-old virgin walking onto the set of a porno movie and finding out that he was the star. Dana presented us with a recording contract, and we signed it. We had never been in a real recording studio before, so we weren't really sure what to do or how it worked. Dana had at least been in with his brother on many of the Pop Art hits. He had ideas of how it should be and what he wanted to hear. The contract dictated that Dana was the producer and co-songwriter of our music. He started telling Jeff to change tempos, to shift pitches, to add cuts and adjust sounds. Jeff disagreed with many of Dana's creative choices, but in Dana's mind, since he paid for the studio time, he was in charge. Jeff was fuming, but this was our big shot, our one chance, so we didn't want to mess it up. Just one of those days got mangled in the recording session. The tempos between the verse and the chorus were different. The song inexplicably changed keys. The mix was awful. Jeff still hates that track, even though we re-recorded it later. But Girls Ain't Nothing But Trouble got through the recording sessions mostly unscathed and still held up as a song. Despite Jeff's grumblings, it was decided that Girls would be our first release as a single and Just One of Those Days would be the B-side. We'd release them to build up some hype while we recorded our first album. The Girls Ain't Nothing But Trouble single came out in March 1986, although nobody knew it because it was on Dana's new record label, Word Up Records. No offices, no employees, no distribution. The single wasn't even in stores. Dana was selling the vinyl out of the trunk of his car. Nothing was happening. To his credit, he was doing everything he knew how to do. He was a hustler. He spent his own money, and he absolutely believed in DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince. Even though nobody knew we had a record out, Jeff's win at the Battle for World Supremacy meant that promoters started calling to put him on shows, and I came as a part of the package deal. We started hitting the nicer clubs around Philly. We played Delaware and Atlantic City. The shows were getting big enough that there were contracts. And on one occasion, we needed to sign and fax one back by 5 p.m. the same day or we'd lose the gig. Jeff and I were scrambling. Who the hell do we know with a fax machine? JL was sitting in JL's corner of Jeff's basement in his own world, reading the back of an Ohio Players album cover, the one with the naked girl on the inside with the honey all over. Jeff and I were getting more and more frantic, trying to prevent this $1,500 from evaporating as 5 p.m. approached. Neither of us had a fax machine. I figured my mom might have access to one at work, but it was already late on Friday. Daddy-O didn't like that newfangled shit. And Word Up Records only had a rotary dial car phone in its mobile business office. JL sat there quietly as Jeff and I became aggravated with each other. You got all this computer shit down here, but you don't have a damn fax machine? I said. You can get a sampling guitar pedal from a Nazi in Vienna, and you don't have no way of faxing a damn contract? How is that my job? What do you do in the group? JL never looked up. And in a bored, monotone voice, he said as much to the Ohio Players girl as to me and Jeff, I have a fax machine. And that's how James Lasseter became our manager. There's a great concept from Jim Rohn. Look at the five people you spend the most time with because that's who you are. This is an idea I've always understood innately. Deep down inside, I knew that my dreams would be made or broken by the people I chose to surround myself with. Confucius had it right. It's nearly impossible for the quality of your life to be higher than the quality of your friends. And by the grace of God, there has never been a single moment in my life when I've looked to my left or to my right and not seen an extraordinary friend. Someone who believed in me and was down for whatever. JL was in his final year of law school, and while it may have been a casual act of convenience for Jeff and me to hire him as our manager, we quickly realized that JL was not a casual kind of guy. He started making contact with all of the venues and concert promoters and began requesting documentation and financial information about record sales and studio costs from Dana. And when he wasn't satisfied with the responses, he hired a New York City attorney to oversee all of our business dealings. JL was one of those guys who didn't care about fame or money. He wasn't flashy, and he didn't want fancy clothes or sparkly jewels. He prided himself simply on defending the people he loved. JL read the recording contract we had signed with Dana. He had highlighted and circled and X'd out clauses, which didn't really matter because we had already signed it. Perched in JL's corner with a perplexed look on his face, he asked, "Did you two read this contract?" Jeff and I kind of glanced at each other. "I didn't read it. Did you?" I said. Jeff shook his head and then to JL said, "Nah, what does it say?" That was not the answer JL was hoping for. "It says y'all are stupid." Dana was always upbeat, telling us how hard he was working and how much money he was spending to promote the record. Jeff had heard it a couple times on WHAT around midnight, and a few friends and family members had caught it, but it was getting spotty airplay at best.
"You gotta bribe radio stations, you gotta wine and dine people. You know, it's competitive. They be trying to join me up. They playing it, though. Y'all just not catching it. Just give me some time. Y'all gonna be huge."
Since I had secretly decided that I wasn't going to college, I stopped doing my homework, I didn't study for tests, and I didn't even show up for a lot of my classes. As far as Daddy-O was concerned, if I was disciplined at the ice house, performed my tasks impeccably, and wasn't getting myself arrested or killed, he was cool. But my mom was friends with all my teachers at Overbrook, and she snapped. My mom's supermost parenting mission was for me and for all of her children to go to college. For her, college was everything. It was what she had picked up and moved to Philly for. It was why she tolerated Daddy-O's drinking and violence. It was a big part of why she moved back to Woodcrest. To her, a college education was the fundamental bedrock of a successful life, and without it, I was doomed. Hope sustains life. Hope is the elixir of survival during our darkest times. The ability to envision and imagine a brighter day gives meaning to our suffering and renders it bearable. When we lose hope, we lose our central source of strength and resilience. My mother's hopes for her kids had sustained her through the darkest years of her marriage. But now I had developed hopes of my own. I had hip-hop hopes. I had hopes for albums and being on stage in front of 50,000 people shouting, "Ho!" when I told them to. These hopes were now empowering and sustaining me. I would have died if I had to give them up. I couldn't. I wouldn't. It came to a head one afternoon toward the end of my senior year. I hadn't come home after school. I had gone straight to Jeff's to rehearse. It was about 10 p.m. when I finally made it home. I could feel my mom before I even put my key in the front door. Sure enough, my mom was in the kitchen waiting for me. "Hey, Mom," I said mock joyfully. "Are you having a problem?" she said evenly. "Nah, I'm good, Mom." "No, apparently you're having a big problem, or at least you're about to." "What, Mom? What happened?" "I just talked to Mrs. Stubbs. After 4 years, you've forgotten where your classrooms are?" "Nah, Mom, I'm just doing a lot of stuff." "What are you doing that's more important than getting into college? You know these schools are going to look at your final senior grades. We have come too far for you to throw your life away now. What is your problem?" My mom's voice and her posture denoted anger, but I saw something else beneath that. She was terrified. My heart melted. "Mom, I've been working with Jeff for almost a year. People say he is the best DJ in the world. Rap is blowing up. It's on the radio. It's on MTV and Run DMC. They went to Japan. I'm telling you, Mom, we are making songs that are as good as what anybody else is doing. Every time we perform, people go crazy. We found a record producer who's putting up money. We have a manager. Nobody in Philly can rap as good as me. Everybody says we're going to be stars. I just need some time to make it happen. No, you can't be a rapper, she said bluntly.
What? Why not?
Because I don't know what that is. You listen to me right now. You will not cut another class. You will not miss another test. You will complete every single piece of homework that is assigned to you. You are going to college in the fall, period. Mom, look, just listen to the music. I've been hearing you hippity-hop around here your whole life. That is a hobby. That is not a career. Good night. She stood up from the kitchen table, turned to walk away, and I stopped her with probably the worst thing I've ever said to my mother. Mom, I'm not going to college. I was here on the backs of generations who had struggled through hardship and sacrifice. The blessed recipient in a long lineage of striving African Americans to have a stable, educated, middle-class life in America. My mom and Daddy-O's generation grew up in the throes of segregation and immense poverty. Gigi's family had escaped the Jim Crow South. My mother had fought through decades of school district bureaucracies, financial uncertainty, and Daddy-O's bullshit to get me to this point. And she was going to be damned if I didn't go to college.